were drawn closely from Utamaro. Van Gogh, by contrast, was most interested by the artist Utagawa Hiroshige. In fact, his painting entitled Bridge in the Rain After Hiroshige is a direct copy of a Hiroshige print. Now, Hiroshige and Hokusai were contemporaries, and to some degree rivals. Hiroshige's famous series, The 53 Stations of the Tōkaidō, is somewhat parallel to Hokusai's 36 Views of Fuji. But Hiroshige was engaged in the same issue, putting ordinary people in his landscape, parents and children and pilgrims. Always like Hokusai, he sought to make the mundane important and beautiful. Well, we've covered a lot of ground today, and I'd like to close with an observation about what Hokusai tells us about our big themes of globalization versus isolation. Now, Hokusai lived a remarkable life, and despite his chronic financial troubles, he lived to be almost 90, and he produced acclaimed work almost until the day he died. And Hokusai lived that long and productive life without ever meeting a foreigner. He lived and died during an era of isolation. But that was isolation from foreign people. It was not isolation from foreign culture. Hokusai knew about Western painting techniques. He even used Western inks in some of his prints. And that points to a fascination with the rest of the world and a hunger for knowledge about the world outside Japan. So Hokusai was something of a paradox, a distinctly cosmopolitan artist who lived entirely in an era of isolation. Now that hunger for knowledge of the outside world, that drove the next cycle of Japanese history, modern globalization. And that's the subject we'll address next time.
Lecture 17, The Meiji Restoration.
In 1904, the famous scholar and translator, Basil Hall Chamberlain, wrote that he felt 400 years old. He was, in fact, only 54, but he was referring to his recent experiences in Japan. Chamberlain had come to Japan in 1873, just 5 years after the fall of the Tokugawa shogunate in 1868. And over the following decades, he had witnessed a breakneck pace of change. He said it was as though he had arrived in Japan during the Middle Ages, but found himself just 30 years later in modern times. For example, Chamberlain described how, when he first arrived, he had learned Japanese from a samurai who carried two swords and wore his hair in a topknot. That was the traditional samurai haircut, with the front of the head shaved and the longer hair in the back and the sides gathered and dressed in a queue. But in 1904, such men were long gone. Now, Chamberlain's description of jumping from the Middle Ages to modern times was an exaggeration. But he was describing something very real. In fact, let's play with Chamberlain's approach for just a moment, but let's stretch his dates just a little. Let's go back an extra 5 years to 1868 to include the last days of Tokugawa rule, and let's add 1 year at the other end to include Japan's victory in the Russo-Japanese War of 1905. So, in 1868, Japan had virtually no railroads or steam engines, and no telegraph capacity to speak of. In 1905, by contrast, it defeated one of the world's greatest military powers with its state-of-the-art navy, and railroads and telegraph lines crisscrossed the country. In 1868, the samurai were still a hereditary warrior class. Commoners were banned from possessing serious weapons. But in 1905, Japan's army was full of conscripted farm boys, and some of the heroes of the Russo-Japanese War were local kids, many of whom had never left their villages before they were drafted. Or how about this? In 1868, public discussion of politics was effectively illegal. Government affairs were the business of samurai, and commoners were not supposed to question their decisions. In fact, even directly reporting the news could be punished as a crime. But by 1905, dozens of daily newspapers reported on local and world affairs. And this press was often brutally critical of the government. They exposed corruption, they complained about taxes. Some insisted that Japan was too meek internationally. Others said it was too aggressive. And there was an elected national assembly called the Diet. It was full of elected commoners. And they were even more critical of the government because while newspapers could be shut down for libel, Diet members enjoyed complete freedom of speech. So this was an astonishing pace of change. And it was also far-reaching. Everything from tangible items like clothing and food and hairstyles to things like the law and business and the army and abstract questions like what is religion and are there things called human rights? In all these areas, we see an enormous radical transformation between 1868 and 1905. So here's the big question. Why? Why did this happen? Well, in large measure, these changes were driven by Japan's most recent cycle of globalization. Globalization Stage 3. And just as with its two earlier stages, Japan changed radically in order to adjust to a new global environment, new opportunities, and new challenges. So what was new in the environment in the late 1800s? What prompted these radical changes? Well, quite frankly, seen from Japan, the world was terrifying. The world was quickly being divided into two camps, the colonizers and the colonized. Virtually all the European powers had colonial empires. And this was not just the major powers like England and France, but also Italy and Belgium and Holland. And much of the Asian world was either already colonized or in the process of being colonized. India, Vietnam, Cambodia, Indonesia. And after the 1840s, the Western powers even began peeling off parts of China, like Hong Kong, as colonial outposts. Now, the Tokugawa shogunate was completely unprepared to meet this challenge. And it's tempting to say that the Tokugawa shogunate was weak because it had no army or navy capable of pushing back against these aggressive powers. But remember, the Tokugawa had let their army decay for a reason. They had worked carefully for hundreds of years to create an international environment where the regime could be safe without an army. Japan and Korea and China had all agreed to stay out of each other's way. So Tokugawa weakness wasn't an accident. It was part of a plan not to need an army. But the Western powers broke that system. These Westerners just kept grabbing stuff. Clearly, they were not interested in staying out of each other's way in the interests of peace. So, from at least the 1840s, with the defeat of China in the Opium Wars, it was clear that the shogunate needed to do something. It needed new weapons and new military organization. But the institution was internally paralyzed. Even after Commodore Perry humiliated the shogunate in 1853, the vested interests against reform were just too strong. For example, one of the key problems of the shogunal military was that it relied on hundreds of different daimyo armies. Those now needed to be consolidated into one centralized command. But here's the problem. The shogun's high-ranking officers themselves were daimyo. The men who needed to dissolve the daimyo armies were the daimyo. That is, the very men who held power would have to voluntarily surrender that power. And what about mobilizing commoners? To create a modern army that relied on the whole country instead of just a hereditary elite. Well, that sounds great unless your government is staffed entirely by samurai who are that hereditary elite and who all might be replaced by commoners. So what was Japan to do? Well, in this environment, certain reform-minded politicians, intellectuals, and activists began looking for a way to break with the unsustainable status quo. And in order to move forwards, they looked backwards to imperial rule. Now, historians refer to this reform movement as the Meiji Restoration. And it's easy to define the start of the Meiji Restoration, the overthrow of the Tokugawa House in early 1868. And it's also easy to point to the major reforms of the Meiji Restoration, the abolition of hereditary status distinctions, the abolition of the samurai class, the creation of a conscript army and navy, the restructuring of land ownership and taxation, the creation of a new educational system, with mandatory primary education at the bottom and Western-style universities at the top. But it's a bit harder to say when the restoration ends. Maybe in 1873, because all of those reforms were announced by 1873. Or maybe 1878, because many of those reforms did not take effect nationwide until about 1878. Or we could argue that the restoration ends with some later accomplishments, such as the new constitution of 1889, or nationwide elections to the Diet in 1890, or even the end of the Russo-Japanese War in 1905. That was when Japan completed the shift from a potentially colonized country to a colonizing power. But however we define the endpoint of the Meiji Restoration, a central idea was the restoration of imperial power. And that's remarkable because the imperial house had not done much of anything in a millennium. The last time the emperor commanded an army was the 700s. The imperial tax collection system was defunct by the 800s. And since the early 1600s, the emperor's duties had been formally reduced to simple ceremonial functions. But that complete disconnect from practical affairs, that was actually part of the emperor's appeal to Meiji reformers. Because whatever had gone wrong in the Tokugawa period, it wasn't the emperor's fault. Imperial authority was unsullied by the inability of samurai to respond to Western imperialism. Now, scholars are still amazed by the astonishing smoothness of the Meiji Restoration. True, it wasn't entirely peaceful, but it was a picnic compared to the French Revolution, or the Russian Revolution, or the Chinese Revolution. Adding up all the domestic casualties from fighting in Japan, from the 1850s through to the 1870s, we get tens of thousands, not millions. And that's largely because the Meiji Restoration didn't pose a stark contrast of ideologies, monarchy versus democracy, or capitalism versus communism. Instead, it was a battle for who would implement radical reform in the name of the emperor. So while there were bitter power struggles, it wasn't the sort of clash of ideologies that would tear a country apart. I often ask my students to guess what happened to the last shogun, Tokugawa Yoshinobu. And they usually assume that he died an ugly death soon after his fall from power in 1868. And that's not a bad guess, because Yoshinobu was vilified by his enemies. They described him as a traitor to the emperor and a traitor to Japan. And if you imagine the Meiji Restoration as a battle between old ways and new ways, well then, certainly the last shogun must have died defending the old ways, right? So you can assume he was executed, right? No, that's completely wrong. Yoshinobu did not die on the gallows. He didn't commit seppuku. He wasn't even thrown in jail. He died in 1913 at the ripe old age of 75, rather wealthy and fully restored to respectability. At his death, he had recently stepped down from the Japanese House of Peers. And that's because there wasn't any point in killing Yoshinobu, because by the time he resigned as shogun, he was basically dissolving the old order on his own. So when Yoshinobu agreed to quietly get out of the way, there really wasn't much to fight about. And some of the shogun's most prominent advisors rather easily switched sides to the new government. And that's a key insight into the Meiji Restoration: the relative absence of a clash between old and new. In fact, we see lots of the opposite, the intersection of the old and new, rather than a direct clash, the complementarity of the Japanese and the Western. So while it's common to say that in the Meiji period, Japan modernized and westernized, I prefer a more subtle phrasing. Japan reformed so as to look powerful and legitimate in a modern Western world. Meiji reforms weren't about making Japan more Western, but about developing a way of Western-oriented way of being Japanese. Now, that may sound like an arcane difference, but since a picture is worth a thousand words, let's consider a specific image. One of the many things the new Japanese government developed was a national currency. Yes, prior to the Meiji Restoration, there was paper money in Japan, hundreds of different kinds of money issued by different daimyo and shrines and temples. But none of it was Japanese national money. It was just different entities within Japan issuing their own private money. The Meiji government found that situation intolerable. So they commissioned some modern, state-of-the-art national money from a modern, state-of-the-art printer, the Continental Banknote Company in the U.S. Remember Ito Hirobumi's speech in Washington? Well, Ito recommended that Japan copy the U.S. currency system. And the result was that Japan's 1873 paper money looks remarkably like U.S. money from the 1860s. For example, if you compare a 10 yen note to a $10 bill, you can see that the general design is the same. The value of the note is printed in the four corners of the bill. There's a large tableau image in the middle, and there are paired medallions on the left and the right of the tableau. It's as if the Japanese government just said, "These bills look great. Just change the dollars to yen and start printing." So this seems simple, right? Japan copied the U.S., and so the new printed money is Western and modern. But it wasn't that simple, because in copying the U.S. banknotes, the Japanese government was also celebrating ancient Japanese imperial rule. So returning to the $10 bill from the 1860s. The tableau is a version of the 19th century painting from the Capitol Rotunda called The Discovery of the Mississippi by De Soto. And it shows Hernando De Soto astride a white horse, his armor gleaming, brave troops at his side, riding in front of half-naked Native Americans, and in the foreground, priests and soldiers are erecting a cross. These visuals aren't subtle. This is manifest destiny in a painting. White Christians were destined to conquer the New World, to bring civilization and religion to naked savages. The conquest of the New World was divinely ordained. Now, the Japanese government obviously did not include Hernando de Soto on their 10 yen notes. But they did choose an intriguingly analogous image. A picture of the legendary Empress Jingu and her legendary conquest of Korea in the 200s. And that's basically a Japanese equivalent of Manifest Destiny. You see, according to Japanese mythology, the gods ordered Empress Jingu to conquer the Korean kingdom of Shiragi, and her conquest was magical. She was pregnant, but she put stones in her womb to delay childbirth until she could defeat Shiragi. And her son, the next emperor, he cooperatively agreed not to be born until she was done fighting. Although he did help direct battles from inside his mother's womb. So the connection between the $10 note and the 10 yen note is thematically significant. Just as 19th century Americans thought that God had given the American West to them, so the Meiji government believed that their gods had given the Korean Peninsula to them. So this is an imported Western technology used to tell the story of an ancient Japanese legend. Empress Jingu matches Manifest Destiny. Now, I don't want to read too much into a single picture, but this one is indeed worth a thousand words, because Japan's colonial conquest of Korea was in fact based on European models of colonial discourse. The new Meiji government abandoned the old Tokugawa model, in which Japanese-Korean relations were kept both distant and vague. Instead, they insisted on a Western model of colonizers and colonized. From the very beginning in the 1870s, the Japanese employed Western advisors to make sure that their colonial claims on Korea made sense in London and Paris and Washington, D.C. They didn't look back and argue that Toyotomi Hideyoshi had invaded in 1592, and so now it was time to finish the job. Instead, they used modern terms like protectorate and sphere of influence. Japan drew explicit parallels between U.S. interests in the Philippines and Japanese interests in Korea. Also between French interests in Indochina and Japanese interests in Korea. This wasn't some crazy territorial grab. This was carefully justified in diplomatic memos, which framed the entire first stage of Japanese imperialism as a counterpart to Western imperialism. And by 1905, the great powers accepted Japan as the new junior member of the imperialist club. So, while it's tempting to think about the Meiji Restoration as this epic battle between the old and the new, or between Japanese tradition and new Western ways, it's actually much more interesting to look at how the government embraced foreign practices while also incorporating Japanese traditions, like the legend of Empress Jingu. Let me give you another example of how new Western ideas were actually combined with ancient Japanese practice. The creation of the modern Japanese army. The abolition of the samurai class and the creation of the modern Japanese army, those were one of the most momentous reforms of the Meiji era. The samurai class was dismantled by a series of edicts in the 1870s, and the government also abolished all hereditary restrictions on employment so that Japanese commoners could now join the military. In fact, the government instituted a draft. So the abolition of the samurai class and the conscription of commoners, that was the end of a Japanese tradition, right? A clear case of modern Western ideas triumphing over Japanese tradition, right? Well, not so much. At least not according to the government edict announcing conscription. In that edict, the government insisted that conscription was not a break with tradition. It was actually the restoration of Japan's true tradition. The edict claimed that in the 700s, the emperor had been the commander of a conscript army, and that during military crises, the emperor had led his people from the highest minister to the ordinary farmer as the head of a national army. Now, that was a rather romantic view of ancient conscription. At the time, being drafted probably felt more like slave labor than noble service to most 8th century Japanese farmers. But the government was right on one basic fact, because at least on paper, the ancient imperial state had a conscript army. And that ancient precedent allowed the Meiji government to attack the tradition of samurai rule as not traditional at all. On the contrary, the samurai were interlopers. Their rise to power had been a symptom of the decline of the imperial house. So now, in the 1870s, Japan was actually returning to the real ancient tradition. Japan was skipping right past all that messy so-called tradition, those centuries of samurai rule, and going right back to the true tradition of the 700s. So conscription was supposedly a return to ancient ways. But it was also modern and Western. In fact, the government declared that they had abolished the samurai class in the name of equal rights and equal duties for all Japanese. Now, if equal rights sounds like a distinctly modern Western concept, that's because it is. But for Japanese reformers of the 1870s, that modern Western concept dovetailed perfectly with their aims. And this dovetailing allowed the government to assert that by creating a modern Western army, they were actually restoring Japan's most ancient practices. Okay, here's a final example. Let's move from geopolitics to public ceremonies. The Japanese emperor was thought to be uniquely descended from the ancient gods by an unbroken line of descent going back to the 7th century BCE. So, what could be more traditional than showing the emperor to the Japanese people? Showing the emperor would be reminding them of their traditions, right? Well, actually, no, not at all. By long-standing practice, only a handful of people, courtiers of extremely high rank, ever met the emperor. Remember how when the emperor wanted to see that elephant in the 1700s, the elephant needed to get high court rank? Now, the leaders of the Meiji Restoration thought that such remoteness made the emperor a lousy symbol of national unity. They wanted a modern monarch, one, yes, with an ancient pedigree, but modern. Because the name of the game was to look powerful and civilized in a world dominated by Western norms. And European kings and queens, they weren't remote and untouchable. They participated in all sorts of public ceremonies. They convened parliaments, they cut ribbons, they christened ships. Everyone knew what they looked like, and that was part of their power. So the Meiji reformers decided that it was time to show off the Japanese emperor. And they sent the Meiji emperor and empress around the country in completely unprecedented fashion. They visited textile mills and schools. They attended the opening of railroad lines. And they met ordinary people, mayors and soldiers and scholars and businessmen, people without any special rank. If you look at where the Meiji Emperor stayed in the 1870s, it was often just the spruced up wing of an ordinary inn. There are Meiji Emperor stayed here plaques in remarkably ordinary places. Now, by the 1880s, the government eased up on these visits. They didn't want the emperor overexposed, but they still wanted him in the public eye. And they wanted European royals to think of the Meiji Emperor as part of their club. So in 1894, the government promoted massive nationwide events and huge public celebrations of the occasion of the silver wedding anniversary of the emperor and the empress. There were special postcards, there were special postage stamps. The government even struck medals, which were given to those who attended the ceremony. But in planning this event, the imperial house had trouble with one key question. When exactly was the emperor's wedding anniversary? Nobody knew. And that's because commemorating an exact wedding day was unknown in Japan before the Meiji period. In fact, the entire celebration of wedding anniversaries was unprecedented in Japanese history. Japan had never celebrated an imperial wedding anniversary before. The idea arose because European heads of state had massive public celebrations for their anniversaries. So, of course, Japan, as a civilized country, needed one as well. So, if we think of the imperial institution as uniquely Japanese and ancient, in contrast to modern and Western, those huge nationwide celebrations make no sense because they were both. They were brand new ways of celebrating an ancient institution. And that's the ongoing legacy of the Meiji Restoration. The synthesis of the ancient and the modern, of the new and the traditional, of the local and the global. That synthesis was deliberately crafted by the Meiji government, and it remains a distinctive characteristic of Japan today.
Lecture 18, Three Visions of Pre-War Japan.
Today we're going to talk about Japan's road to World War II. But I'm not going to describe that road purely in terms of battles and treaties and major events. Instead, I'd like to consider the early decades of the 20th century by looking at the lives of three important individuals, each of whom offered a distinct perspective on Japan's place in the world. The individuals I have in mind are Nitobe Inazo, Shidehara Kijuro, and Ishiwara Kanji. Nitobe and Shidehara were both proponents of Japanese democracy and international cooperation, although from somewhat different perspectives. Ishiwara, by contrast, was a die-hard militarist. And we can understand the fate of Japanese democracy and Japan's road to war by examining how and what made each of these men influential. So let's start with Nitobe Inazo. He was a true cosmopolitan, in some ways an exemplary product of the Meiji Restoration. Educated largely in the United States, with an American wife, he was probably as comfortable in Washington, D.C. as in Tokyo. And his great accomplishments were representing Japan to the world, both through his writings and through international organizations. For example, he was Undersecretary General of the League of Nations and Director of the International Committee on Intellectual Cooperation, which you probably know by its post-war name, UNESCO. So, if I had to summarize Nitobe's approach to the world in one slogan, I'd use the optimistic words, peace through mutual understanding. So where did Nitobe come from, and how did he become one of Japan's most influential spokesmen in English? Well, Nitobe was born in 1862, just a few years before the beginning of the Meiji Restoration. And as a student at Sapporo Agricultural College, now Hokkaido University, he converted to Christianity. He went on to study at Tokyo University, but by 1883, he was already consciously styling himself as a bridge across the Pacific. So he traveled to the U.S. in 1884 and continued his studies at Johns Hopkins. After completing his academic work at Halle University in Germany, he returned to Japan and became a professor at Sapporo Agricultural College, but not before taking an American wife, Mary Patterson Elkington. So here we have a Meiji-era educator who's thoroughly steeped in the ways of the West. And it was in part this deep connection to the West that drove Nitobe to write a very influential book called Bushido, The Soul of Japan. Composed in English, this work attempted to offer Westerners a sort of inside view of Japanese culture and traditions. In fact, Nitobe said the book was prompted by a question from a Belgian jurist who wondered how the Japanese taught ethics and morality since they did not have religious instruction in schools. Now, this was an especially fraught question for Nitobe, since as a Christian, he represented a tiny religious minority in Japan. But he pondered the question, and he concluded that Japanese morality was not rooted in Buddhism or Shinto or even in religion per se, but in Japanese chivalry, Bushido. Now, you may recall that the word Bushido literally translates as the way of the warrior. But Nitobe's book is not a coherent historical account of Bushido. Rather, it's a series of sometimes strained comparisons between Bushido and European chivalry. In fact, Nitobe was most interested in establishing Bushido as a coherent ethical and moral tradition, leading people to be stalwart, brave, honest, dutiful, and generous. And it's an eccentric book, but those very eccentricities made it a huge success in the West. It was translated into 10 languages, and Nitobe produced no less than 12 revised editions. And the impact of the book was enormous. H.G. Wells read it, and he wrote a now largely forgotten book called A Modern Utopia, in which the utopian society is governed by an intelligent, physically rugged, self-sacrificing elite called the samurai. Robert Baden-Powell, founder of the Boy Scout movement, read Bushido, and then he included samurai stories in his collections of inspirational stories for Boy Scouts. Teddy Roosevelt also read the book, and he started practicing judo. So we can't underestimate Nitobe's role in the Meiji era, especially his impact on Japan's image overseas. Nitobe was a major reason Japan was seen as progressive and civilized in the West. And this favorable view of Japan was one reason why the U.S. and the U.K. were actually supportive of early Japanese colonial efforts in Taiwan and Korea. In essence, Japan was seen as bringing progress to backwards places. One observer wrote that Japan needed to send 100 intellectual samurai policemen to Korea to clean up backwardness and corruption. Moreover, in staking a claim to Korea, Japan was actually fighting against Russia, which served British and American interests just fine. But then in 1905, the West's perspective began to change. To put it bluntly, the UK and the US were delighted so long as Japan was building a colonial empire at the expense of Russia. But after 1905, it looked as though the Japanese Empire might clash with European and American ambitions. And as a result, the period between 1905 and 1918 was tense. because Japan was now an imperial power, but it was unclear where it sat in the pecking order of great powers. But in the wake of World War I, Nitobe saw an opportunity for Japan to participate in a multinational effort to shape a peaceful and democratic world order. And Nitobe's vision of Japan's role was bolstered by the surge in idealism and anti-war sentiment. The devastation wrought by modern weapons had shocked the world, and a generation of idealists insisted that World War I would be the war to end all wars. Now, I'm sure you're familiar with the institutions and the agreements that emerged from that generation. The Paris Peace Conference, the Permanent Court of International Justice, the League of Nations, and most remarkably, the Kellogg-Briand Pact, in which the signatories pledged not to use war to resolve disputes. Both the U.S. and Japan signed the treaty. Now, in East Asia, post-war optimism produced one of the world's first major arms control agreements. That emerged from the 1921 to 1922 Washington Naval Conference. And according to the agreements reached at that conference, the great naval powers in East Asia, Japan, Great Britain, and the U.S., agreed to limit the size of their fleets. And they also agreed to stop carving up China. They would no longer establish colonies or special spheres of influence. Instead, they would each recognize each other's rights to trade in China, and they agreed to support the establishment of a stable, unified government in China. So the great powers, in a sense, agreed that they would compete economically, but not militarily. Now, Nitobe was fully supportive of these military and economic agreements. And many historians consider the Washington Naval Conference a great achievement in arms control. But for Nitobe, the most exciting thing about the end of World War I was the start of a new era of intellectual and cultural exchange. And his greatest passion was a non-governmental organization he co-founded in 1925, the Institute for Pacific Relations, or the IPR. The IPR gathered businessmen, educators, and intellectuals from across the Pacific in order to discuss problems, and in a spirit of cooperation, basically to fix the world. The group exuded Wilsonian optimism and idealism. The first meeting was held in Hawaii, and Frank C. Atherton, one of the richest men in Hawaii, declared, with no apparent irony, that their goal was to turn men from selfish ambition toward reason, justice, and liberality. And Nitobe poured his heart into the IPR. At the opening of its 1929 meeting in Kyoto, his address was full of idealism. The Pacific lands, he declared, are to be the stage where shall meet all the races and cultures of the world, but not in the spirit of conflict, but with a will to understanding and peace. Unfortunately, by 1929, Nitobe's idealism was facing a serious challenge from within Japan, because men like Ishiwara Kanji were causing trouble in Manchuria. They were trying to carve out a sphere of influence for Japan despite the agreements of the Washington Naval Conference. And thus, at the Kyoto meeting, Nitobe found himself apologizing for Japan, saying things like, "Japan has committed some grave errors in dealing with China." And then, in a wonderful turn of phrase, describing the different policies of different factions within Japan, he admitted that Japan might look like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. Now, Nitobe did not explicitly name the other two men we'll discuss today, Shidehara Kijuro and Ishiwara Kanji. But we can think of Shidehara as Nitobe's Dr. Jekyll, the gentle philanthropist, and Ishiwara as his Mr. Hyde, the depraved murderer. So let's turn from Nitobe, who was committed to the idealistic goal of peace through international and cultural exchange, and let's explore the personalities of his Jekyll and Hyde. In the years leading up to World War II, how did Shidehara and Ishiwara understand Japan's place in the world of nations? Well, let's look first at Shidehara Kijuro. He was the diplomat who represented Japan at the Washington Naval Conference. And in many ways, he was similar in orientation to Nitobe. Both could speak English with ease. Both were married to Christians, although unlike Nitobe, Shidehara's wife was Japanese. But Shidehara was far more practical than Nitobe. If Nitobe's slogan was peace through understanding, then Shidehara's was more like, let's make peace more profitable than war. And I say this because Shidehara, while arguably a pacifist, was married into one of the most powerful business interests in Japan. His father-in-law was Iwasaki Yataro, the founder of Mitsubishi, the single most powerful conglomerate in 20th century Japan. So Shidehara, whether he was serving as foreign minister or even briefly as prime minister, he never had a gauzy vision of peace through mutual respect. Instead, he argued for peace in terms of a business plan. So, for example, let's consider the question of a possible Japanese invasion of China. Shidehara's thinking ran more or less like this. If Japan were to invade China, it might conquer and hold parts of it. But whatever parts of China Japan did not control, those would be fiercely anti-Japanese. And they would probably boycott Japanese exports. So you'd actually lose more of the China market than you would gain. But what if Japan did not invade China and instead helped China establish a stable and independent government? And then Japanese businesses, including Shidehara's in-laws at Mitsubishi, they would have access to the entire China market. So it was a pretty practical plan. And this is also why Shidehara pressed so hard for arms control. A naval arms race with the U.S. and Great Britain would be very expensive. So Shidehara's approach to economic growth was essentially, don't undermine a chance to dominate a huge emerging market by starting an arms race you can't afford anyway. But what's remarkable about Shidehara is how committed he was to a strong China. He was more committed to Chinese territorial integrity than either the U.S. or the U.K. We can see example of this in the so-called Nanjing incident. In March of 1927, the armies of the Chinese nationalists and the Chinese communists together retook the city of Nanjing from a local warlord, Zhang Dongcheng. Now, the details are still contested. But when the Chinese army retook Nanjing, soldiers from either the nationalist side or the communist side, or possibly both, began attacking the foreigners in Nanjing. They tried to kill businessmen, diplomats, teachers. Nanjing was a major treaty port with a substantial foreign community. Now, in response, the U.S. and the U.K. sent in warships, and they began attacking Chinese troops with machine guns and high explosives, and Japan was asked by Britain to join an expedition to reestablish order. But Shidehara, who was then foreign minister, refused. He argued that while foreign troops should protect their own residents, they needed to let the Chinese leader, Chiang Kai-shek, get control of his own army and punish his own troops. Foreign intervention would likely just make matters worse. So under Shidehara, Japan's response was markedly less aggressive than that of either the U.S. or the U.K. So clearly, Shidehara's policies were a distinct contrast to the goal of a military conquest in China. His policies were based on peaceful competition for Chinese consumers instead of military competition for Chinese territory. But even when Shidehara was at the peak of his power as foreign minister, militarists like Ishiwara regarded him as weak and dangerous. He was lambasted in the right-wing press. And then, starting in 1929, Shidehara's world began to unravel. So beginning in October 1929, with the New York stock market crash, the world economy began to collapse. Stock markets from London to Tokyo fell. And with that, all the optimistic talk of international cooperation and trade. And in the face of this economic crisis, the U.S. implemented strict import restrictions. The famous Smoot-Hawley Tariff Act of 1930 placed large tariffs on imports to the U.S. And then all U.S. trading partners retaliated with tariffs of their own, and world trade collapsed. So all of Shidehara's talk about Japan not needing to establish a special sphere of influence in China, but instead relying on free market access to a larger market, that vision just died. And that was Ishiwada's cue. It was time for the military to take action. Now, Ishiwada was a graduate of the Japanese Army War College, where he lectured in military history from 1925 to 1928. And during that period, he developed an apocalyptic doctrine of a final coming war. For Ishiwada, World War I was absolutely not the war to end all wars. It would soon be followed by World War II, and then by a final war, World War III, which would result in complete world unification. And this coming World War III would be a war between Eastern and Western civilization. And therefore, in Ishiwada's mind, it would be a war between Japan and the U.S. So it was critical for Japan to stop all this idiotic prattle about a new era of cooperation and free trade, and to begin instead grabbing all the resources necessary to fight this final war. Ishiwada's understanding of the world was both terrifying and visionary. He observed that military mobilization was growing more and more extensive over time, and that this expansion was erasing the line between civilian and soldier. So he predicted that armies would soon be targeting their enemy's civilian population, and that they would do so with amazing new weapons, including airplanes that could fly around the world with just a small crew and bomb targets anywhere at will. Now, with this vision of a coming apocalypse in mind, Ishiwada was transferred to Manchuria as an operations officer in 1929. Now, as part of the Treaty of Portsmouth, ending the Russo-Japanese War, Japan had won control of key railroad lines in Manchuria. And the Japanese army in Manchuria, called the Kwandong Army, was supposed to protect those railroad lines. But Kwandong Army officers were intent on using that power to carve out a Japanese sphere of influence in Manchuria. And the Japanese army in Manchuria also had a long tradition of insubordination, of even ignoring direct orders from Tokyo. But Ishiwada, he raised that ambition and that insubordination to a new level. In 1931, with the collusion of mid-ranking officers throughout the military, Ishiwada helped organize the invasion of Manchuria and the creation of a new puppet state, Manchukuo. Briefly, the events went like this. The Japanese army faked an attack on the South Manchurian Railroad, and then they deployed troops to suppress this, to suppress the very attack that they themselves had staged. They routed the troops of the local warlord, and then, rather than simply declare that they had staged a coup, they orchestrated a conference demanding the formation of an independent country. And then they proceeded to place a puppet ruler on the throne, Puyi, the last emperor of the Qing dynasty, who had abdicated at the advanced age of 5. And thus, Ishiwada and his military cohorts created a new country, Manchukuo, and they presented Tokyo with a fait accompli, a Japanese puppet state in Manchuria. Now, these actions had not been approved by the Japanese government or even discussed at a cabinet meeting. In fact, when it seemed that civilian officials were becoming suspicious, the Kwandong Army had actually accelerated their plan. And the creation of Manchukuo sealed the coffin of the internationalist dreams of the 1920s. First, men like Shidehara knew that they could not face down the army over this. It was one thing to prevent a coup. It was another to tell the army to give up territory. And it didn't help that back in Tokyo, right-wing extremists were beginning to eliminate their opponents. These groups were a mix of military men and civilians, and they were commonly both anti-communist and anti-capitalist. They considered capitalism a corrupt and exploitative system. But they also rejected the communist solution, class warfare and revolution. Instead, they thought that Japan could achieve a post-capitalist utopia through the emperor system. A shared love of the emperor would bind everyone together in an egalitarian community. All they needed to do was kill the capitalists and the civilian politicians who supported the capitalists. And these men emphatically supported plans for a great overseas empire. Now, amidst the despair of the Great Depression, these extremist groups became increasingly brazen. They shot one prime minister in 1931, they killed another in 1932, and a remarkable number of elected civilian politicians died because they were deemed either too complicit in capitalism or insufficiently aggressive in China. Japan continued to hold elections into the 1940s, but fear of assassination stifled most of the opposition. Now, Ishiwara's creation of Manchukuo led to the end of Nitobe and Shidehara's vision international cooperation. China insisted that Manchukuo was a puppet state, and they demanded a League of Nations investigation. The League set up a commission, and that commission reported that Manchukuo was not a legitimate state. The League approved the report, and then Japan quit the League. So the invasion of Manchuria was a crucial moment. It closed off alternative paths proposed by Nitobe and Shidehara. It ended Japanese reliance on multinational agreements, and it became clear that the U.S.-Japanese rivalry in the Pacific was now going to be military. Maybe just an arms race, maybe all the way to open war, but it was certain that, for the moment at least, Ishiwara's militaristic vision had won the day. So how did the aftermath of the invasion play out in the lives of our three subjects? Well, Nitobe was devastated. He knew the army's actions were illegitimate, but he somehow felt obliged to defend Japan. And those two impulses were, of course, completely incompatible. And at a meeting of the Institute for Pacific Relations in 1933, he and the other Japanese delegates struggled painfully to explain their nation's actions in Manchuria. And soon after that meeting, Nitobe collapsed from pneumonia and died shortly thereafter. Now, I don't think one can literally die of a broken heart, but I think Nitobe's death was hastened by the despair of seeing his life's dreams collapse. As for Ishiwara, well, the Japanese army did not quite know what to do with him. He was intelligent and charismatic, but he was also consistently insubordinate. And he was so enthralled by his own vision of Japan's future that he was unable to compromise with anyone else. In fact, he managed to alienate almost everyone in the military. For example, he once publicly denounced General Tojo Hideki as a nitwit whose major accomplishment was misdirecting army funds to a ridiculous pet project, a club for officers' wives. And as a result, Ishiwara was moved around in the army until he was forced into a very early retirement in 1941. Just months before the attack on Pearl Harbor. Now, ironically, that endless insubordination probably saved Ishiwara's life in 1945. Because the U.S. occupation had no idea what to do with him. On the one hand, the invasion of Manchuria was the start of the road to war between Japan and the U.S. So it seemed like Ishiwara was a